Public Radio KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas & Go at the Y, and Gas & Go at Mill Bay.
It's nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, we are your public radio station, broadcasting from Kodiak, Alaska, where we have 63 degrees here on Burrow Hill under overcast skies. Out at the airport, they have 60 degrees, 70% humidity. They are recording northeast winds at 6 miles per hour and 10 miles of visibility. Look for increasing clouds today with a high near 64, calm winds turning to the west to 5 this afternoon. A 20% chance of rain after 4 a.m. tonight, but otherwise mostly clear skies tonight that will gradually become cloudy toward daybreak. Low of about 52 overnight tonight. Coming up on the Midday Report, Dylan Simard with the report on two gubernatorial candidates who stopped in Kodiak. And travelers with COVID were not allowed to go back on their cruise ship, but they were put on an Alaska ferry.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden went to Kentucky today to survey damage from flooding that ravaged parts of the state last week. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports Biden highlighted the role of climate change in worsening natural catastrophes throughout the United States.
President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden traveled to eastern Kentucky to visit with families impacted by last week's historic flooding. 37 people were killed in the storm and its aftermath. Biden is vowing that the federal government will stay as long as it takes to get this recovery going and to help communities bounce back.
And I promise you, we're staying, the federal government, along with the state and county and the city, we're staying until everybody's back to where they were. Not a joke.
Biden noted that this is the second time during his presidency he's visited the state. Last December, he came to Kentucky to tour damage after another deadly storm-related event, tornadoes. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
In eastern Kentucky, local media report law enforcement and residents were paying tribute to a high school football player who fell ill while helping with flood recovery and died a few days ago. The Lexington Herald Leader reports a police escort was expected to accompany Aaron Mick Crawford's remains from Lexington, where he'd been hospitalized, into Perry County. The young man's death, the latest in a series linked to flood disasters that claimed at least 37 lives. A federal judge in Georgia sentenced Greg McMichael and his son Travis to life in prison for federal hate crimes in connection with the kidnapping and murder of Ahmaud Arbery in 2020. He's a young black man who was chased down and fatally shot after the McMichaels and their former neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, saw him running through a residential neighborhood. Bryan was to be sentenced this afternoon. Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper-Jones, says she's satisfied with the outcome.
At this point, it is what it is. They did what they did, and now they have to pay for whatever they've done.
Today's federal life sentences are largely symbolic because the three defendants have already been sentenced to life on state convictions. The Pentagon has announced another $1 billion in military assistance for Ukraine, one of the largest single packages to date. NPR's Greg Myrie reports this comes as fighting is picking up in southern Ukraine.
The latest U.S. package includes a wide range of ammunition for the most powerful and effective weapons the Americans have already sent to Ukraine. The Pentagon says the ammunition is for howitzers, anti-aircraft systems, and the recently delivered artillery systems known as HIMARS. All this reflects the heavy daily use of rockets and artillery in a war now in its sixth month. The announcement comes as Ukraine has stepped up operations in the south in an effort to reclaim territory taken by Russia early in the war. This pledge brings the Biden administration's military aid to Ukraine to nearly $10 billion. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
It's NPR.
NPR News es presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Election season is underway for Alaska's race for governor. Former governor and nonpartisan candidate Bill Walker made a campaign stop in Kodiak during Crabfest weekend in late May. Former Alaska State Representative and Democratic candidate Les Guerra also campaigned in Kodiak in late July. KMXT's Dylan Simard spoke with each candidate and their running mates during their visits to the island and has this report.
Fisheries policy is one of the most pressing issues for many Kodiak voters, and former Governor Bill Walker says local fishermen need to be better represented on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which oversees fisheries in Alaska's exclusive economic zone.
There's 11 seats on there, which Alaska has 6 and Washington has 5. So I want to make sure that we have people on there that know who they represent, that they're wearing our uniform, so to speak, the Alaska uniform.
Former State Representative Les Guerra argued that Governor Dunleavy's appointees to the council had not done enough to act in Alaska's interest.
The people that he nominated, they voted to not do anything about chum, salmon, bycatch in a year where fish are not going up the Kuskokwim.
Both candidates say that Kodiak is the poster child for renewable energy and support further development of renewable resources in Alaska. And when it comes to the Alaska Marine Highway system, each candidate agreed that it's a vitally important connection for rural coastal communities. Walker's running mate Heidi Dreigas was born in Fairbanks and moved to Juneau in 2015. She says it's given her a new perspective on the value of the ferry system.
It's frustrating to hear about the days of old when we had a vibrant marine highway system with, you know, in the 90s, where we had a predictable schedule, the ships were in good working order.
Guerra also wants to build a more reliable ferry system and blames present-day woes on the current governor.
I would reestablish a pre-Mike Dunleavy marine highway system, one that works, one that is affordable for people, one that has scheduled frequent marine highway stops. The marine highway is important to businesses. It's important for tourism. It's important for residents.
Kodiak is host to the largest Coast Guard base in the United States, and both candidates were asked about Arctic security. Walker says he wants the Coast Guard's new icebreakers to be homeported in Alaska instead of Seattle, and he also supports the construction of a Navy base in Alaska.
I have had conversations with the Secretary of the Navy, talking to him about the reopening of ADAC or another coastal port that provides a naval presence in Alaska. The response I got was that if there was a need or a concern, it would be covered. Alaska would be covered out of San Diego, which just didn't feel quite as urgent as I was interested in.
Guerra says he's in favor of increasing the size of Alaska's Coast Guard presence.
We want to Alaskanize as much of this fleet as possible, from Homer to Nome to Juneau. There are harbor and port expansion needs that could help local communities first, but also be built in a way that could house the federal vessels.
Whether their stances resonate with voters is yet to be seen. The primary for Alaska governor is fast approaching on August 16th. Early voting has already begun in some Alaska communities, and absentee in-person voting started in Kodiak on August 1st. In Kodiak, I'm Dylan Simard.
Last week, some travelers who had tested positive for COVID-19 were not allowed to reboard their cruise ship in Skagway. Instead, they say that Holland America helped them book travel on a state ferry, then an Alaska Airlines flight out of Juneau, the day after their positive tests. KTOO's Claire Stremple has that story.
Diana and Larry Lehrer were supposed to set sail from Skagway on Holland America's Koningsdam after a bus tour through the interior in Canada. But they tested positive for COVID-19 when they reached Skagway.
And the first test went fine, the second one didn't.
Expect to. We're going to fly out tomorrow morning.
In approximately 10 minutes, vessel will be getting underway for Haines. All visitors ashore, all visitors ashore.
Instead, the couple is on the state ferry, sitting masked near the front windows. The MV LeConte is packed with passengers from Skagway and Haines headed to Juneau.
So they wouldn't let us on the cruise ship because that's asking for trouble. So they gave us the option of quarantining here in Skagway or going home.
Diana says she was aware when she booked the package that if she or her husband tested positive during the bus trip, they wouldn't be allowed on the cruise ship.
We just didn't think it would be us.
She says Holland America took care of them after they tested positive. The company paid for their hotel room and delivered meals.
You know, they walk you through everything, so it was easy to do.
They totally rebooked our travels back. Yeah. Made it very easy. I mean, like within 10 minutes.
Within 24 hours of testing positive and being denied entry to the cruise ship, they're on a ferry headed home. A Holland America spokesperson said that's not the company's policy. It will only help customers reschedule travel after they quarantine for 5 days. But Mr. Lehrer later confirmed in an email that after one night in isolation in Skagway, a Holland employee did book their travel.
I know that that happens.
Skagway Mayor Andrew Cremata says ferry or plane travel out of Skagway for travelers with active COVID-19 cases is not part of the municipality's port agreement with Holland America.
So there have been groups of people with COVID at the airport that have been sent home and they're trying to fly out. And then there's been groups of people that have been put on the ferry.
You don't have to test negative to board one of the state's ferries or an Alaska Airlines flight. But both companies have policies that say you should not travel if you are sick. Laura Bronk and her husband were on the same tour as the Lehrers, and they're on the ferry too after a positive test. Bronk says their tour guide recommended the ferry over a small plane out of town. She says the cruise company offered them 5 nights in isolation in Skagway, but they decided to check out and get on the ferry instead. She says the company will reimburse them for the ferry ticket.
You know, your vacation's over, you might as well go home.
As for the Lehrers, the couple plans to catch flights from Juneau home to the East Coast. They say their symptoms are mild, a runny nose, and a little bit of a cold. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strumpel.
In 2016, a mid-air collision between two small commercial airplanes near Russian Mission resulted in the death of both pilots and all passengers. Following the crash, one of the companies and the widow of the pilot pursued a lawsuit against the other company. As KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports, late last month the case was settled, and the pilot's widow is feeling relieved.
Last month, Hägglunds Aviation, better known as Raven, paid out $2.5 million in a lawsuit filed against them. This closes a chapter in the now 6-year-old story of pilot Zach Babbitt, who was killed in a mid-air collision involving two small commercial airplanes. In 2016, Babbitt was piloting a Piper Super Cub for Bethel-based Renfro's Alaskan Adventures. He and a Renfro's guide were flying from Bethel to a hunting camp, cruising at over 1,000 feet. That's when a Cessna Caravan took off from Russian Mission and essentially ascended into Babbitt's plane. Both planes tumbled to the ground and all 7 people on board, including both pilots, were killed. Following the crash, Zach Babbitt's employer Renfro's and spouse Carrie Pride filed the lawsuit against Hägglund.
Really, the motivation here was to show that the other party was at fault and to make them push to improve their safety.
The lawsuit against Hägglund alleges that it was completely at fault. Attorneys for Pride hired aviation experts who concluded that the pilot of the Cessna Caravan should have had a clear view of Babbitt's Super Cub while taking off. Pride says as a pilot of nearly 2 decades, her husband was known throughout the state for his high safety standards.
My husband flew for Hägglunds for a little while and he left because of safety and concerns.
Settlements don't point to fault, but Pride says she sees the high dollar amount as an admission of the carrier's wrongdoing, and there was no countersuit filed.
It gives me relief because I know like Zach was not at fault in this, and I feel like I did my job for Zach and his good name and for Renfro's.
But Pride thinks airline safety in Alaska still has a long way to go. An investigation by Unalaska public radio station KUCB and ProPublica last year revealed that Alaska is the least safe state for small airline travel. KUCB reported that almost half of the nation's small plane crashes are in Alaska. And there were 5 mid-air collisions in the 5 years following Zach Babbitt's plane crash. The report attributed the crashes largely to inexperienced pilots, a lack of support while flying in remote areas, and poor infrastructure at rural airports. Pride said the lawsuit was agonizing and lasted as much as 2 extra years due to the pandemic. She's glad this chapter of her life is behind her. She's looking forward to continuing her work with Babbitt's estate. He was a prolific wildland painter who took much of his inspiration from scenes he witnessed in Alaska. She said because of that, she's set up a scholarship in his name for art students in Babbitt's 2 beloved home states of Alaska and Montana. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
Is it okay for the city and borough of Juneau to publicly take sides on local ballot questions? The Juneau Assembly wrestled with that question during a meeting last week. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has the story of where they landed on the issue ahead of the October election.
The discussions leading up to the Juneau Assembly's final votes to put three questions on the October ballot that all have to do with city infrastructure and how to pay for it were brief and straightforward. That was not the case for two related topics that followed, on whether or not the city should actually take a side on two local ballot questions. Most assembly members hesitated.
This is a tricky one.
And it's tricky.
This one in particular is a tough one.
I was on the fence on it. People said they really wrestled with the last one, and I know I did.
City Manager Rory Watt had asked the assembly to consider letting him and his staff support an initiative that would authorize the city to borrow money to build a new city hall. A separate ordinance would have let the city oppose the citizen-led effort to repeal a mandate to disclose real estate sales prices. Alaska law generally bars state agencies and local governments from using their resources to influence the outcome of elections. However, City Attorney Rob Palmer told the Assembly that using city resources to inform and educate the public is okay. City Manager Rory Watt explained what that means practically.
It's likely that we would have a very muted public involvement and very limited. I would not want to put my staff in a position of making an APOC violation.
APOC is the Alaska Public Offices Commission, the state body that receives campaign finance complaints and fines people for violations.
It would be a fine line to walk.
For example, there are some common sense reasons that city officials want a single new city hall building instead of its current arrangement spread across multiple buildings.
I think it's quite tricky. So in making the business case for city hall, some of those arguments are subjective arguments. So saying things like having all the offices in one place would be more convenient and more efficient, right? Are those facts or are those suppositions?
State law does leave a pathway for state agencies and local governments to legally campaign on ballot questions on the condition that state lawmakers or local elected officials pass legislation that sets aside money specifically to influence the outcome of a ballot question. That's what the city manager was recommending and what prompted the assembly's debate. David Ignell of West Juneau weighed in during public testimony.
To me, it doesn't seem right that government would get involved in taking an advocacy position in an election in a political matter like this. I think it sets very bad precedent.
Assembly member Carol Treem was sympathetic to the point, but struggled with how to vote on the real estate disclosure advocacy question. Real estate professionals and developers are leading the repeal effort, which began with the citizen petition process. They say the policy is an invasion of privacy.
And that means this small group was able to organize, and the benefits of mandatory disclosure are a lot more diffuse across Juneau. So it's really unlikely that there's going to be a competing advocacy group that organizes for the election to support mandatory disclosure.
Most assembly members think mandatory disclosure will lead to more accurate property assessments and more fairness in property taxes between different kinds of property owners. Assembly member Alicia Hughes-Scandes called the pro-repeal side a special interest, but she couldn't get behind the city stepping in to oppose it.
When I picture myself in the shoes of a citizen who got together with other citizens and gathered enough signatures and knew I was getting something on the ballot, I asked myself how I would feel if then the government was spending my funds to work against me.
The assembly voted unanimously to keep city staff neutral on the real estate disclosure repeal. Of course, the assembly members themselves, they can advocate their positions on ballot questions without using city resources. Here's assembly member Michelle Hale.
I think it's much more appropriate for assembly members to do that job. I think that is our job to do. That is our responsibility.
The vote on having city staff support the city hall question also failed, but with three yes votes. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
K
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.